Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, all theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL, and welcome to another episode of Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history and legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. This series is called Tesori Hour, covering all five musicals that have bowed on Broadway, composed by Miss Janine Tesori. I am your host, Matt Koplik, the least famous and most opinionated of all the Broadway podcast hosts. And with me today is a musical theater writer. He's a composer. He's a lyricist, a librettist as well. Yes, he does all of it because he likes working by himself, much like a certain character we're going to be talking about today. You might know his works of American Morning or The View from Here. Yes, I did my research. Please welcome to the podcast, Timothy Huang. Hi, Timothy.
I'm so done. That was hilarious. Oh, my God. Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm great. I told Timothy before we recorded, but I'll tell the listeners, I am in the perfect mood to talk about a specific show that we're going to talk about today because I'm grumpy. Timothy's been so lovely. He's been very accommodating to timing, and I had to move the podcast back a little bit today to accommodate some things I had to do, only for my phone to get completely fucked up at the gym. A weight came down on it, and there are no cracks or anything like that, but it did power off completely and it won't power back on. So I had to cut the gym short. I had to cut all my other activities short, came straight home, was able to get an appointment with Apple for later tonight. But basically I'm just sitting here going, I don't like this. So I'm in the perfect mind frame to talk about a certain show. Timothy, what show are we talking about today?
We are talking about Shrek the Musical, baby.
Exclamation point, man.
Yeah.
So Timothy, two questions.
Sure.
When did you become aware of Janine Tesori? That's question one.
Okay. That's a good question. I would say that the first time I was aware of Janine Tesori was when I got called back for Thoroughly Modern Millie, because in a former life I was an actor.
Yeah. Weren't we all? Was this Broadway Thoroughly Modern Millie?
No, it was for the first national tour. So I remember they comped me to see Millie at the Marquee, and I was so excited because I'd never had seen free Broadway before. Mm. And you know, I didn't know Sad Foster. Like I didn't, you know, and I was like, this is amazing. I want to go on tour with the show, even though, you know, the character that I'm being considered to play is not the most I don't know, constructive archetype.
Sure.
But I was like, yeah, I was already like spending that money, you know, had not been contracted yet to have. And of course I did not get it because of course I am not an actor. I'm not a competitive one at any rate. So that was my first Tesori encounter.
But you are charming, and that's why they called you back and had you come see the show. That's what it was. So that was the first time you saw a show and you're like, Janine Tesori wrote this.
Yes.
Lovely. I mean, I hate to ask the obvious, but I mean, what did you think of Sutton?
Oh my God. I was amazed by her. I thought to myself that it was kind of this double discovery. The first was, oh my gosh, she was this person. The second was like, are women allowed to be funny and like, you know, like romantic characters also, like at the same time? Like, what's that about? Why haven't we seen more of this? Is she like a unicorn, or could it just be the patriarchy?
It's everything. I mean, I know what you mean, because usually in a romantic musical, the leading lady is allowed to be quirky, but not necessarily funny.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like a Meg Ryan who peels her apples with one slice, like in Sleepless in Seattle, or, you know, reads all the books and You've Got Mail, but never necessarily gets to be sort of like messy funny. And that's something I always loved about Sutton. We'll talk about it with this show as well, because she really gets to go for broke here. You know, yes. Just being messy funny. I talked about it in the Millie episode already, but that was when Millie came out. I was already very much in love with Broadway at a young age, but that was when I started to become aware of the optics of Broadway. So I was very aware of like her trajectory, her narrative, her storyline. Right. And so I was like so on board with, you know, this Star Is Born moment. And so I'm just, no matter what she does, even if I don't love the show, I will love her and will always go see her.
Yeah, I gotta say, like, I mean, I think in 2022, Tim would look back and say that, like, one of the reasons that's been super prohibitive is because, like in terms of characters only allowed to be quirky versus, like, messy, is because of male gaze. Like, that is really what I would call it. It's like, wow, those female characters are not allowed to be dirty. They're not allowed because that makes us feel things about ourselves or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Which, like, is just like a single person cannot apologize enough for even, I think, like consuming that kind of media for so long. Like, it's just so disgustingly like bothersome and embarrassing. So, you know, I'm glad that like we're glacially paced towards the opposite of that spectrum.
Yeah. I mean, the more of it that we get, the more we can absorb and learn and move away from archaic ideals, which brings us to my second question. When did you become aware of Shrek the Musical?
Oh, well, you know, I actually saw it in its original Broadway run. So I guess then, I'm not sure, as we've discussed off camera, I'm friendly with David Lindsay Baer, and I'm pretty sure like at that point I would have known that he was writing it. So probably like, you know, a year before they opened, it would have come across my radar. To be perfect, full disclosure, I wasn't a huge fan of the first film. I eventually, like, I got it, you know, and its subsequent sequels. But like, for me, like all of that, like that tone of non sequitur, you know, one in joke after another, one reference after another, like that worked for me when I was coming of age and watching like Wayne's World. Right. Mm-hmm. And his references were like relevant to me and my maturation or whatnot. But with Shrek, I was just a little bit older and I was like, oh, I don't really understand what this is. I mean, I get that it was sort of the anti-fairy tale. So I was never like a fan. I saw it and I was like, okay, done. You know, so that David was writing this at all was probably something that I would have heard and just kind of not really clocked because it wasn't really relevant to my interests per se. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I, you know, whenever it opened on Broadway, that would have been what, 2008
going into 2009. Yeah. Wait, are you telling me that this was a movie that they adapted into a Broadway musical?
Totally original, right?
What the hell? Oh my God. Crazy. Has that ever been done before?
I don't think so. I think this was the first one. Absolutely.
The first one ever. Totally fair. Listen, the first Shrek movie came out. I was the perfect age to see it. I was 11 and it was like, it's that age where like you know enough to get a lot of the jokes and you think that you're clever because you're getting a lot of the references.
Yeah.
And then when you get a little older and you look back, you're like, oh, these references are pretty obvious and like low-hanging fruit. the fact that like it was so hysterical to an 11-year-old tells you sort of the level of craft that goes behind it. Look, I have seen the movie a couple of times now, and I do think the movie is still relatively good. There are some jokes that hold up, some that it's like, that's stupid. It's sort of like, but I remember everyone thinking like how brilliant it was because it was deconstructing fairy tales. I'm like, Into the Woods did that first and much more complex. Shrek is like, let's not talk about, you know, the toxicity of parenthood and childhood and just talk about how everyone has layers. But I did enjoy the movie for a time. When I remember when they announced this was going to be a musical around like 2004, there was no creative team yet. They were just like, Shrek's coming to Broadway at some point. And we were all like, yeah, sure, whatever. And then it was announced that David Lindsay Abaire was going to write the book. Jason Moore, who directed Avenue Q, was going to direct it. And they're like, we don't have a lyricist or a composer yet, but it's coming. It's coming. Again, everyone's like, yeah, sure, we'll believe when we see it. And then like a year later, they announced that Janine Tesori is going to do the music, that David's actually going to write the lyrics. And that was when I went, maybe, just maybe, this won't be the worst thing ever, because David, you know, with Kimberly Akimbo and Fuddy Mears, and I think Rabbit Hole had come out, I think, at that point. No, Rabbit Hole.
I want to say 2009.
Maybe.
Google
that for me. Google that, will you, dear? I believe Rabbit Hole was the year before Shrek came to Broadway, but I could be wrong. And then Janine, I was obsessed with Millie as a kid, and then I saw Caroliner Change, and a monster was born, because I was just like, oh, this mind-bogglingly brilliant score has turned me into an elitist asshole for the rest of my life. Especially because then I saw Light in the Piazza like 9 months later. Like, I seen Caroliner Change in May of 2004 and then Light in the Piazza in March of 2005. There was no going back for me. I was like, oh, I am going to sip tea with my pinky up and tell everyone that they're garbage. And so I was very excited for Shrek. It came my freshman year of high school. Freshman year of college. What am I saying? So I never actually got to see it on Broadway because the majority of its run, I was in school, and then I was at Williamstown for that summer. So, and then back to school. So, and it had only about a year long run. So I just never really got a chance to see it, but I did listen to the score once or twice and enjoyed it. And I remember thinking like, I feel like this is getting a bad rap. I don't know why. And then I watched the Netflix filming in prep for the episode I did on this 2 years ago with one Josh Burridge. And for anyone who wants to come for me for doing this episode again, first of all, it's a Janine Tesori series, get into it. Second of all, I don't remember what I said 2 years ago to Josh. It was in the middle of lockdown, we all blacked out. So I may repeat myself, I don't know, I don't care.
And third of all, I'm like the least derivative person that you'll ever meet. Like my work isn't derivative of anyone ever.
You are just like a musical based off of a movie. Totally original, never done before. No one's ever seen it.
Exactly.
So I already kind of gave a little bit of background on this musical. You know, the timeline of announcements and whatnot. Obviously, we had the 2001 film, which was based off of the children's book from the early 90s by William Steig. The interesting thing about, or Steig, I don't know how you say his last name. The interesting thing about Shrek the movie, I don't know how into like movie trivia or history you are, Timothy. I weirdly listen to more movie podcasts than I do to theater podcasts, because I find theater podcasts to be relatively dry, which is why I made this one, because I was like, let's get educational, but with some flavor.
I love it. I love it.
So Shrek was produced by DreamWorks, which was founded by David Geffen, Steven Spielberg, and Jeffrey Katzenberg. Katzenberg founded it after being fired from Disney, where he helped sort of launch the Disney Renaissance with Michael Eisner and Howard Ashman and Alan Menken and all their collaborators. And Shrek was supposed to be a pretty direct 2D animation adaptation of the book, which I was doing some research on, and has almost no resemblance to the movie that was made, other than the fact that he's an ogre, he has a donkey, and he marries a princess. Everything else is like pretty much completely different. And Katzenberg took it over and decided to make it a giant fuck you to Disney by having it, by incorporating basically every Disney fairy tale film ever and just poking fun at all of them. Peter Pan, Alice in Wonderland, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, all that, Snow White, like it just really just like shitting all over it. And the ultimate fuck you is that Shrek won the first Oscar for animated film. They make so much money. It has all the sequels in the world, a million spinoffs. And the one thing he needed to do left to kind of really conquer Disney was bring Shrek to Broadway, because until that point, Disney had conquered Broadway in a way that DreamWorks never really did. So he was hoping Shrek would kind of do that. The irony is that I think this actually has a better score than a lot of the Disney Broadway shows, but you watch the Netflix movie and you're like, oh, I see why this didn't totally land. Mm-hmm. And I don't blame David Lindsay Abaire or Janita Sori, especially because this morning I watched a bootleg of the Seattle out of town tryout for the show. Yes, which I send you not thinking you would ever watch it, but just like, right, here's an option if you have two and a half hours free.
And I didn't, but I'm going to go back to that because I had a very similar response to the Netflix screening as you did. But also, though, it echoed my response seeing it from the balcony when it was on Broadway at the Broadway. But like, I want to talk about that, but I feel like I'm getting ahead of ourselves. Please keep going.
It was just so, it'll all sort of get wrapped up as we talk about it, but yeah, like I'm watching the Seattle version and then the Broadway version. There are certain changes they made that make a lot of sense. A lot of it musically, the way that they kind of tweaked Who I'd Be. So it was a little more of a complete act one finale. They made, gave a little bit of an overture and an end track. So the whole thing had a bit more pomp and circumstance to it. But the other thing is that a lot of the drier humor of the book that David had written and a lot of places where he deviated from the screenplay got cut, and they added in more stuff from the movie. So there are a lot of things that you look at, like, you know, and some things are funny, you know, the donkey, he talks. Yeah, it's getting it to shut up. That's the trick. Like, it's a funny line direct from the movie. It wasn't in the script when they were in Seattle. They added it back in. And, you know, it's interesting to see how these two really brilliant writers who were definitely, you could tell from Seattle, were trying to find a way to balance the familiar and doing something new with it, ultimately got strong-armed. No matter what they say, it's the proof is in the pudding. They got strong-armed into incorporating more of what people knew by,
you know, if I can just jump in for a second.
Jump
though,
in, please.
I just want to, this is kind of relevant because I spoke to David about this particular aspect of it, like just in terms of like curiosity, like how could, when you're working with a known quantity, there must be some pressure, I asked him, to kind of incorporate things that are referential. Otherwise, what would be the point? And his response was very, very surprising to me. Like, he said, I think maybe they'd said, oh, well, we like this and this, but we were given free rein to really kind of make something of our own, which I think shows a lot of trust, because like look at who we're talking about. Of course you give them carte blanche, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course you trust that they know that there are certain touchstones and whatnot that would probably serve to be, you know, inserted and whatnot. But I was expecting him to be like, Tim, off the record, oh my God, they were just such tyrants and blah, blah, blah. But he was like, no, they just kind of let us go. And
maybe that's true from before Seattle.
Is kind of what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, and to be fair, like, they do keep a lot of the stuff from out of town, you know, a lot of the music and certain moments in the show where it's like, this is a lot more quiet and introspective than the movie ever hoped to be. But you can, maybe it wasn't even DreamWorks. I don't want to put, you know, any words in anybody's mouth, but you do see from Seattle to Broadway, they go a little more in the direction of what the movie was. And it's a shame because in some of those quieter, drier moments, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. That's fun. That's cool. Although they did make more changes again when they went on tour. And then again, when they went to London, where each time they sort of revised it after Broadway, the response was better because they also simplified the design. They made it a little less extravagant. And everyone's like, oh yeah, this is not quite so theme park looking anymore. It's a little less overt in the humor. This is actually quite charming now, which I think is good. I like that. But yes, you watch the Netflix movie. First of all, it's terribly filmed.
It's not great.
And that doesn't fall on anyone's shoulders but whoever directed the filming. They don't adjust any of the lighting really, so a lot of it looks very dark. They go between like wide shots and then up close shaky cam, which is odd. But on the bright, and not all the performances translate to film. Some of them are, you know, done for the back of the house and feel like it's for the back of the house, but some things translate very well, like, you know, Sutton Foster, because, you know, she knows how to do it.
Keep your big, bright, beautiful world. I'm happy where I am, all alone. I got all I need, so read a stinking sign. Keep your big, bright, beautiful world.
Timothy, for anyone who lives under a rock or in a cave or in a swamp, let's say, what is Shrek about?
Oh, that is such an interesting question. I mean, like, well, let's talk story. There's a character named Shrek. He's an ogre. Let's limit it to what we've seen on stage, right? So he's got these like really, really shitty parents who say, you know what, have fun, here's your bag. Don't let the door knock your ass on your way out. And he set out alone, and like, he kind of grows up to be a curmudgeon. So our story starts when this very, very minuscule person who fancies himself an overlord starts pushing the fairy tale creatures out of his land, and they've come to occupy Shrek's space. And he's like, no, I'm not down with being around with anybody, so y'all have to get out. And they're like, well, we can't get out because we've just been displaced. We are refugees. So you got to go talk to this dude, Farquaad, because like Farquaad, he kicked us out. And for some reason, he's allowed to do that. So in an effort to save his sanctuary and his sanity, he goes on a journey to convince Mr. Farquaad to retract and, you know, and renege. Farquaad says, you know what, I'll give you your swamp back if you can rescue this Princess Fiona for me, because I'm actually just sort of like I'm sort of the steward of Gondor. I'm just kind of sitting here on somebody else's throne. And in order for me to really be royalty, I need to marry a princess. So he's like, done and done. Let's go get this Fiona lady. And it's really just like him kind of over that time learning a little bit more about himself and how he isn't as much of a curmudgeon as he fancies himself to be, or I guess put another way, that he in fact does need people. I would say on a larger level though, this play for me is more about how like diversity isn't something that we should shun or that we should be ashamed of. It's actually something that makes us all stronger. And on a micro level, just sort of like, I mean, the song "Let Your Freak Flag Fly" says it all, right? Like, and frankly, it's not at all subtle in that it has a big bad wolf who's all, like a cross-dressing wolf. So, in case you didn't get the metaphor, here's a character who actually has a kink that should not be shamed.
Absolutely, and the show does not shame him, not one bit.
And you know, no, which is, you know, what I very much love that about. This production. But how did I do? I mean, I kind of feel like that's sort of what it is. And then there's like a dragon and a donkey, and there's onions and layers. And
The big thing is that Shrek ends up falling in love with the Princess Fiona, who is not nearly the typical princess that he thinks she is, and to be fair, is the image she tries to present, but she is not naturally that. And she has her own secret. Yeah, it's finding the beauty within yourself, accepting diversity, understanding the importance of a community. Something that I really like that the musical explores, at least musically speaking, that the film doesn't delve into quite so much, is the difference between putting up a wall because you don't like people and putting up a wall because you're afraid people don't like you. There's a difference between boundaries and walls, right?
Yeah.
A boundary can be moved. It's something that you can work through. A wall is impenetrable. It is a fortress, and that's an important distinction. Shrek doesn't have boundaries; he has walls.
Yes, very well said. I like that a lot.
Thank you. I didn't go to school for psychology, but I know words. Yeah. So, what is a moment in the show that you think works, at least on a text-based level?
Okay, let's see. A lot of it works. You know,
Let me put it this way. What is a moment where you go, oh, that was really smart of them to musicalize this moment, or how they musicalized it.
Okay, well, I'll tell you this. What I thought was, when I started watching this thing, I was like, okay, so this is a known quantity. People sort of have this expectation of what it is. And it is sort of one of the progenitors of like this new form of animated storytelling, where it's just like beat by beat by beat by beat. And we're just, once you get on that train, you don't stop. And it's not like, it allows itself to kind of go in different directions, and wherever it lands, it lands. Because prior to this, I don't really feel like maybe Pixar was doing it something similar before, but this was sort of where I started to realize, oh, like people aren't interested in taking their time anymore when they're storytelling. So given that, like when I first started watching, I was like, oh, right, how are they going to fit like his, that wasn't really an I Want song, you know? And when we're talking about musical theater, there's always this number that like usually comes at the beginning where the character, the main character sort of defines themselves by singing about what they want or how they choose, they're planning to attain it or whatever that is, to give us kind of an insight into that character. And I'm seeing all these characters sing, not really getting that insight. And then at the end of Act One, we get this like, honest to God, I Want number. And it's like all three of them to a degree. And I was just like, that's such a fantastic way to end an act when you can afford to do that, because people already know what the show is for you know, to some extent. So that actually really worked for me. And I would never have done it. And I haven't really seen any innovation in that until Encanto, which is like a whole other thing. But to see that like the form was kind of subverted really satisfied me.
Personally. Absolutely. I feel like I'd call Who I'd Be an I'd Want song instead of an I Want song, because he's not even so bold to say like, this is what I want. But he's like, if I wanted things, I guess I would want this, which is it's like how Rodgers and Hammerstein created the conditional love song. It's the If I Loved You, People Say Love. This is the conditional want song, which is so clever and works perfectly in context with that character. You know, the what is it sometimes says, like the form is dictated by content. So
content dictates form.
Thank you. So it's very similar to that. And I like it great. I'm so glad you said that. That is one of my personal favorite songs. And it's really creatively brave of them to close Act One that way, for something like Shrek the Musical, where you'd expect it to be like this big, especially like the movies has a famous scene where Robin Hood and his bandits try to kidnap Fiona, and she has this big like karate matrix joke scene where she fights them. Like, they could have made that the Act One finale, where, you know, there's a big dance break and she kicks ass, but they close it on a much softer, much more humane note, and I love that, because, you know, they're good fighters. I'd share my heart, confess the things I yearn, and do it all while rhyming.
But we all learn. An ogre always hides. An ogre's fate is known. An ogre always stays in the dark and all alone. So yes, I'd be a hero.
And for every time that I would get annoyed with Shrek the Musical watching it on Netflix, and again, it tended to be the moments where it pushed, there would be moments like Who I'd Be, or even, I mean, I Know It's Today is another favorite song of mine. I love how they showed the passage of time, but also again, has these moments of where it's both very funny and clever, but then also very human. There's a great point towards the end of I Know It's Today. All the three Fionas do their three-part harmony, which I don't care who you are. I don't care how esoteric you are. If you do not get a jolt of musical theater thrill from all three of them going, it's
then me, you're Fiona, dead inside.
You are dead inside. That it's me, Fiona, into then I know he'll appear. And then they're each singing their how many days they've been waiting. Because the whole point of I Know It's Today, right, is, you know, it's she's in the tower for 20 plus years. And each time we see her at a different age, she goes, today's the day, I know it. And they count the day. And we get the tally from Sun, which is the I don't even remember the actual number. It's day number 4,000 something. It's something like that. 4,000 something in 23, indicating like 20 plus years. And the way that it's written and the way that Sun performs, it is so like tired and almost sad because it's just been so long. And it's really, I hate to use the word again because it sounds so overused, but brave to like have that moment of just quiet introspection to really let the audience know before we end on a big money note here, because we're going to end on the money note because we need it. But before we do that, we want to really drive home to you guys how long this woman has been waiting and what it's doing to her psyche and to her self-esteem and to everything.
I know it's today. I know. I know it's today.
I like it. I like it very much.
I do too. I do too. I was going to say something about that. I had the good fortune of. The Drama League honored Sutton a couple of years ago. This is a pre-pandemic honored Sutton Foster for their whole like annual fundraiser thing. And my wife, who's a director, was directing it. I had, prior to that, worked with them on two other galas, just kind of like cobbling music together and maybe substituting like parody lyrics and stuff like that. So sort of like a music supervisor sort of thing. And because I was married to the director this time, I got to do it as well. So I was sort of on board for that in the meetings. And we saw that number. And I just remember that like, two younger Fionas had come back to do a thing, and like they had done, like I think what they had redone was I Know It's Today. And I just had this moment of like, you know, when you see something like on celluloid or in video in digital form at a certain age, and then they kind of like grow into like a human being, like a full person, and then you sort of imagine like that full person doing the thing that they did as a kid and how it would be different and how it would be the same. But like, and then you think about somebody like Sutton Foster, who is essentially ageless. Like it was just this really like transcendent moment, I guess is really all I can describe. Yeah, I was just like, wow. I looked over at my wife and was like, you worked with them, right? She's like, yeah.
No, I would have peed myself. Yeah, she's just the best. I mean, going in a totally different direction with this show and her character and the score, this might be the only musical where two characters fall in love via flatulence.
I mean, it has to be. It couldn't possibly not be, right?
Well, it's not the first musical to use flatulence in a song. I believe that honor goes to South Park Bigger, Longer, Done Cut.
Okay, fair. Yes.
At least using flatulence rhythmically speaking. But it definitely is the first one, or yeah, it has to be the first one that uses it for romantic purposes. And I mean, I even like it here. This is honestly all the Fiona Shrek stuff in this show works very well for me. It tends to be the supporting characters. I know like people really love Lord Farquaad in the show, and Chris Eber does a very good job, and you know
wouldn't they love him? Yeah.
Yeah. And the fairy tale characters are characters everybody knows, but those are actually the scenes that don't hit as hard for me. It is truly the stuff that is character based with the two of them that I just really go, this is very well structured, well written musical theater.
And the genuine tragedy when he hears her in the forest and just completely misconstrues what she's saying because he takes it out of context, like that is Aristotelian tragedy to a definition, to a T, which is like we don't get that in contemporary theater, you know, like we don't get that as often as I would like. So
yeah,
I'm sorry, please continue.
So I want your input on this as well. So this is the I Think I Got You Beat song, which yes. Act two, where they are comparing traumas,
pity parties. Yeah.
Okay. Pity, who gets the largest medal for their trauma, which yeah. is very relevant because that is what a lot of people do today. Luckily, they do it for more comedic purposes. They don't go that deep, but there is a great moment because they each talk about, you know, she was in isolation, his parents kicked him out of the house, and then they go into counterpoint, which Janine loves to do, She does it quite a few times in Shrek, actually. But Janine loves a good counterpoint. She loves a good mashup because she did start her career off as an arranger and music director. So she's got a good ear for that, of how to write stuff that can just coexist. And it's something that you can only really get away with in musical theater in terms of the economy and driving home the point so simply and emphatically is when they sing at the exact same time. I miss my prom. My dad and mom sent me away, and they have a beat and they realize they have something in common. And then it goes quiet and it just takes that one line for everyone to sort of go, we know what just happened. It was really powerful. And then it goes funny again because they start repeating the chorus quietly, but they're not really trying to prove a point anymore. And then as it builds and builds and builds, Shrek cuts one, just lets it rip, and we think, oh, the moment's ruined. But no, Sutton bends over like the goddess she is, lets it rip, and then it turns straight into South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. And I like it very much.
Yeah, do you know, I actually bumped on something different about that number, which I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I need to go back and see and watch it again. But like, when I was just listening to the verse material of this song, I kept seeing the structure of it like on the page, you know, and it wouldn't really stick in my mind. The reason being, the composer always subverts it. Like, one of the things that I think sets like her apart, like next levels her from most other composers doing the same thing, is that like she'll take something and kind of I want to say Christopher Walken it. Do you get that reference?
I think so. Continue. I'll see if I can make connect the dots.
So the reason I say that is because I guess apocryphally, I've never seen this interview, but somebody asked him, "What's the first thing you do when you get a script?" And he says, "Take out all the punctuation." Like that's literally. What he does is take punctuation out of the script. Anyways, that was terrible.
More cowbell, yes. He has a fever.
And so like she'll kind of like, instead of give like a melody that really like puts those lyrics in the pocket, which we know she can do. She's done it, you know, there are examples of it in this score. She kind of like deconstructed that verse material and kind of just fit it into her groove. And so I was trying to, you know, imagine it on a page and it really, I couldn't get it to cement because the music kept on deliberately disagreeing with it. And I was just like, this is so fucking cool. And you know, she does that a lot too. Like, I know we're not talking about, Soft Power, with yet fingers crossed it comes to Broadway. Love that show. But she does a lot of it there too. And it's just like, God, like, I wish I could do that. I see something and if it's not like kind of cookie cutter, I don't even know. But like, wow. Like I was like, this just keeps me listening. It keeps me paying attention. You know, I try to anticipate. I'm always wrong and therefore I'm more invested. And then the farts and you're like, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well, better out than in, I always say.
Absolutely. No, I think that's very insightful. And you listen to, when you do eventually watch the Seattle video or some of the songs from the Seattle video, it's important to know, like, some of the songs that make it to Broadway don't totally crystallized yet, like, you know, Who I'd Be hasn't fully crystallized in Seattle. There's another one that doesn't really Oh, Donkey Pot Pie, which now is a song called Forever. But the dragon, they never really knew what to do with. It was originally one actress and a giant puppet. Then they made it three actresses for Broadway, which I still don't understand. I mean, maybe just because Janine's like, I really like three-part harmonies. She's like, the radio is my favorite thing to compose for in Carolina Fair. Change.
Fair.
Yeah, she can write all the harmony she wants. She's Janine Tesori.
I looked at that as a sort of a band-aid, though. Like the other problem, you know, you take a giant iconic dragon like that who's supposed to fall in love with Donkey and has like her own like agency. Mm-hmm. And then you replace her on stage with a puppet that doesn't really get to move, doesn't really get to do anything. Like, you need to give us something else to kind of snack on.
Mm-hmm.
So you give it, you know, three-part harmonies and a fantastic vocalist and blah, blah, blah. I mean, that, I don't know if that any of that's real or not, but I was sort of like, that's probably
why. I think you're right. They were trying to find a way to make the puppet more engaging, mm-hmm. since because it is this giant thing that was also so cumbersome. Yeah. And what they ended up doing with, like, the mirror for the magic mirror with John Tartaglia, it was the magic mirror at first, and like he came out at one point. And I feel like that's what they tried to do with the dragon, and it didn't work as well. Okay. Because whereas with like John Tartaglia, it like the mask and the mirror didn't stay up there while he came out on stage. Whereas with the dragon, like that puppet is still standing there, huge as all hell. You really needed to kind of think a little more outside the box in terms of the design of that. And I think, again, that's something that was one of the hindrances to the Broadway production, is while there was so much creativity that went into, I think, the score, I felt there was less creativity in the design. I mean, that three-part turntable is cool, but like the rest of the design was pretty literal. And the costume designs too. And in fact, going on for a second about like sort of the aftermath of this show, Ben Brantley's review of it in the New York Times was... The show actually got a pretty interesting array of reviews when I went back in my research, because I think people like to think, oh, this was so underappreciated. And that's up to interpretation. But its reviews were relatively positive, considering this was another...
Brantley didn't like it, though, did he?
He didn't really like it, no. But considering this was another cartoon to Broadway transfer, you would think, oh, God, like, I'm sure the critics just slaughtered it. They didn't really. A lot of the critics acknowledged that it was better than a lot of the other ones that had come to Broadway before this. And Brantley even said, so he's like, it's better than Mermaid. It's better than Tarzan. But that's not saying much, because those shows blow. But the thing that Brantley liked most was Sutton. And his reviews of Sutton and his reviews of Janine shows are interesting, because he gets more complimentary as time goes on. Because the first show of Janine stories he ever reviewed was Violet, which he didn't really like very much. And then he hated Millie. And then he sort of respectfully disliked Carolina Change. And then with Shrek, he was like, listen, not my cup of tea, but they did better than I thought they would. And then Fun Home, he's like, oh my God, best musical of the year. And Sutton, it was sort of the same thing. Like Millie, he didn't really care for her. Little Women, he's like, I don't care for her, but I like her more than I did in Millie. Drowsy Chaperone onwards, he's like, I like her, I like her. And then Shrek, he's like, Broadway star. And he even mentions like some songs he thinks works. But the point I wanted to make was, he talked about how what makes it so difficult to translate a cartoon to stage is what felt so light and fluid and airy on film just becomes like thuds on stage, because it's in human form and it's real and it has a weight to it. Because there's so much you can't do with real live human beings.
Flat.
Yes, very flat. And it doesn't matter how much you make Brian D'Arcy James look like the cartoon, he can't move in the same way that an animator can make Shrek move. And the sets can't be as seamless as you want them to be. It's all just so heavy. And I feel like it would have behooved them to go even further away design-wise from what people might have known. It could have also bit them in the ass that way as well. But, you know, I think of something like Julie Taymor in Lion King, where she really kind of just went so far in the other direction and it totally worked.
Right.
But also after she did that, Disney tried to continue going that route. They're like, okay, let's find someone, the last person you'd ever expect to direct a Broadway musical, get them in here. Francesca Zambello, who only does operas, let's get her to do Mermaid. Bob Crowley only designed sets, let's get him to do Tarzan. It bites them in the ass. And so everyone's starting to go, maybe we bring back people who know how to direct musicals, and we go with what people expect on a Broadway stage and we call it a day. So, you know, you swing back and forth with that pendulum.
It's so interesting. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry, I'm please talk about what I was about to say was I forgot where we were before I went on this rant.
We were just talking about the set and that space. And,
yeah.
Before we started recording, had similar feelings about watching it in that space. Like my takeaway, and this is completely, I'll start. My takeaway was I didn't enjoy it in that space because that space was actually too big. I felt like they were trying too hard to fill it. What was an otherwise very like intimate story. And it occurred to me that maybe the plan had been, which I later found out was incorrect, but I'll say this anyways. The plan had been, let's make a show that schools and community theaters will license the crap out of and put it on a Broadway stage so that we can have that like that seal of that Broadway seal, that nice, fresh, pretty seal. But it'll like really like be a thing that everybody gets to do. Because it felt like it was just sort of, it was begging to be scaled down. It was begging to be more intimate, in my opinion. And then, you know, that's when I texted David and I was like, hey, was that ever like on your agenda? Was like, let's just hit Broadway, but like, let's make sure, you know, cause I had asked him, how often does this get done? Like in schools now? And he gave me his numbers and it was pretty impressive still. And I was like, was that always the plan to like kind of make it a hit elsewhere? And he's like, no, we wanted to write a Broadway show and we did and they did, right?
Yeah.
So I was incorrect. But like I feel like that theater too, like the Broadway theater, it's huge. It's so huge, fucking King Kong was there. Do you know? Mm-hmm. So like something like this, it seems like it would want to be on a stage, really a really big stage, but like it almost felt like a what's the word, I guess diminishing returns is really the closest thing I'm thinking of, because like you have all these little characters and filling up this huge space and they're all these little one-liners, right? And I'm kind of like missing a lot of them because I don't really know where to look or where to focus. Then you have this giant dragon, but you have three voices underneath it. I still, again, I don't really know where to look. And like, it was just sort of a lot of like, gosh, I just wish this was smaller. I wish this was smaller. I wish, you know, there wasn't this pressure to put on stage what was on, you know, celluloid, which I think is kind of what you're saying, right? Like,
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Different responses or different thinking of different workarounds or whatever for the same, we're responding to the same thing. This is what my.
Yeah, no, I think what's interesting is your idea of sort of what the ultimate plan was. I think it can feel that way because obviously hindsight's 20/20, right? And then, and you look at the larger picture of it. And I mean, you know, when you write stuff, it's hard sometimes to see what's so obviously there because you're so in the thick of it, right? Especially these guys, they've been working on the show for years. All this money's invested. They're out of town. They're doing tech. Like at some point you can't see the forest for the trees anymore. And I mean, I know that they had some different Broadway people come to Seattle to sort of take a look at the show and tell them, give them insight. And one of the major things they did was they really kind of streamlined the book because I think the show was clocking it at almost 3 hours when they started in Seattle.
Yeah.
And I mean, and watching the Seattle video, which I think was pretty still early in the run, and then seeing Broadway, some of the changes were smart, like the whole opening number used to be longer because it was like when the parents sang to him, it was all just them. And then he went on his way. And they're like, well, what if while they're singing to him, he goes on his way? That's like 2 minutes right there that we've cut. And other things that just, you know, like get back to the story. And that all is well and good. But two things that you just reminded me of when you were talking. I swear this wasn't me going, I have a thought, let me wait till it's my turn. I was listening and you made me think of something. One is it is an intimate story because a lot of the show is really just a three-person road trip, right? And then the other thing is that it's hard to the show. It's supposed to be like an underdog story, right? Like it's not a fairy tale itself. It's sort of the anti-fairy tale. And like what if you live? Like what if a regular person woke up one day and they were in a fairy tale? Like how would they respond? And wouldn't that be weird? So it's not necessarily a magical story. it just has people who are a part of those things. So it's hard to kind of root for an underdog story when you see $40 million up on stage and all this technologically savvy shit going on. You're like, I can't buy that you're the underdog. It feels like you're part of the system.
Because you look so expensive.
Yeah, you look yeah. so expensive. And I mean, again, there's nothing wrong with expensive, but I agree with you. Like, I think, and the Broadway is a huge theater. I think the two things that work well in that theater are tried and true spectacle or overly emotional musicals. That's why Les Mis, the original production, fits so well there, because that show is just 3.5 hours of melodrama. It is people feeling all their feelings, and it fits there because, you know, it hits the back wall. It's why the movie is kind of preposterous, because they try to make it intimate and you're like, well, this seems silly now. You buy it much more in an 1800 seat theater when you see the whole bigger picture. Shrek should have been in some place like the Neil Simon, or even like the August Wilson Theater, where it's, you know, 1300 seats maybe, and it's like a medium-sized musical, and you can have all this invention in there, but you don't want it to seem bloated. It needs to be lean, and it needs to be up close, and it needs to feel like we're all on the same level of the inside joke.
Sing a song, hit the trail, forget the maps, forget the guides, before you know it, you've made strides with me. And I know all I need all along is a path and a pal and a song. So I'm singing and I'm palling with you. See, makes the time go by faster. Why me? Why me? This is nice.
Tell me. That's such an interesting point you make, because I mean, I'm going to kind of a non sequitur. I had gone to see Honeymoon in Vegas when I was at Paper Mill.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is begging to be huge, right? And then they transferred and moved into the Niederlander, and they had to downsize it because it's small, and probably, like, you know, they're going to pay for what they're going to pay for and what they have. So, like, that's not, you know, I've never had a Broadway show, so I don't mean to, like, but it was noticeably smaller and more intimate. And I was like, no, I want this bigger. I want this, like, bigger and brasher. And it's so interesting that when I think of Broadway, it's always just like, it goes to 11, right? Mm. But, like, even at that level, there are some things that are too big and some things that are too small. And I just think that's really fun and interesting and cool.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for me, you know, like on the internet, people are like, it's the such and such for me, sis. Like, there are people who have like hardcore rules that they think Broadway should be. And it was very fascinating in the era in which Diana was on Broadway. Now, I don't know your thoughts on Diana. I love it. Not because it is good, but because it is Diana. And I had some conversations with some people about it, because I've been very vocal on social media about my love of the show. But I always thought I was pretty transparent about my love, being like, no, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. I'm obsessed with it. This is Mommy Dearest on stage level of camp. And people going, but it's just so Broadway. It's got all this dancing and big, bright sets and hummable songs. I'm like, first of all Broadway is supposed to be is the cornerstone of art and commerce. It's supposed to be the highest level of fully formed shows that can also be, you know, sold to the masses, I suppose, but also like it, you know, have innovation and all that other good stuff. Broadway is not like specifically chorus lines, high belting, right, and bright sets. Every show is different, and what it needs is different. So yeah, like Honeymoon in Vegas, that would have been a show that would have benefited from being a little larger, a little flashier, a little brighter. Shrek was one that should have been smaller. It's all about timing. It's so crazy how like the one decision that seems, you know, inconsequential at the time could really make or break it.
It's true. And when you, I don't know if you have any friends who produce Broadway or have written for Broadway, but when you hear the stories about how they get to decide like what show goes in what house, I mean, it's, well, it just seems like not chaos, but like a situation over which no creative force has any say, which yep. makes it all the more like that anything succeeds at all is kind of like, how did you do that? Because there's so many variables, you know. I was going to say something. You remind me of something that now I cannot remember, so never mind.
Good morning, birds. Good morning, trees. Oh, what a lovely day. The sun's so big, it hurts my eyes. But really, that's okay. A brand new day with things to do. So many plans to make. I've had 6 cups of coffee, so I'm really wide awake. I've always been a morning person, a morning girl. Hooray.
What is a song in the show that you maybe think is less successful?
That's a good question. I did find that there were a few that weren't what I wanted them to be.
Mm-hmm. What a wonderful way to word that.
I was going to say, actually, what I forgot was I was going to say about Diana is the thing that I appreciate most about it. And I tried to see it 3 different times. I've seen it exactly once. Full disclosure, I'm a Tony voter, which means I like when they, you can ask to go back and see. So I made several attempts after seeing it at Invited Dress to go see it again, because I really thoroughly enjoyed it. Is that it knows exactly what it is. Like, you know, it doesn't claim to be anything that it's not. And that's the thing that like is my sort of true north in terms of evaluating or appreciate. Like, if I don't know how to appreciate something, I ask myself, what is it trying to be? What does it tell me? What is it telling me it is? And how does what I perceive of it differ from that? If that makes sense. Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense. Timothy, I'm going to need to meet you in person, get a drink with you, because I need to discuss with you whether Diana does know what it is or not, because there are times when I think it is totally in line with what it's trying to do, and times where I'm like, I don't think you're doing what you think you're doing. But it's weirdly, it's the times where I don't think it's doing what it thinks it's doing that I love it the most. But
okay.
But I absolutely hear you. I saw Diana on Netflix. I then saw it in previews, and then I saw their second to last performance. I didn't get to go to their last performance because I had tickets to Lehman Trilogy, and they announced their closing like a week before they were closing, and I was devastated. But I went to the second to last show.
I'll tell you, it's a lot more like the two things of what it's trying to be and what it's claiming to be are a lot closer now in New York than I think when it was in San Diego. I'll say that.
That is what I am meant to understand, but. The one thing I will say about Diana, and we're not going to talk about Diana anymore because we're running out of time and we got to finish talking about Shrek. I don't think Diana is good, but it is never boring. It is so strong and wrong the entire time that it is so insanely watchable. Anyone I know who was like, oh, I couldn't get through it on Netflix, I'm like, how could you look away? Because there are shows out there that are bad. The one that I will always have no qualms shitting on, everyone knows this, is Finding Neverland. Where like, you can be bad, but don't waste my time. If I'm looking at this stage and going like, this is a cash grab, you're just trying to put a movie on stage, you did nothing. Another one was Pretty Woman, where I'm like, you literally put the screenplay on stage and gave it pop songs that mean nothing. I'm like, don't waste my time here.
Those Diana, are my favorite musical. No, I'm kidding.
And this podcast is over. Diana, never waste your time. Shrek, I think, is sort of half and half. There are times where I go, oh, this is really interesting. This is fascinating. We kind of talked about it with, you know, like Donkey Pot Pie with the dragon, like not really fully there. And I don't know if they ever would have been able to. I think that's just sort of one of the limitations of stage.
I think it's a combination of the limitations of stage and what stage audiences will allow to be done on stage, right? So, because like, do you remember, I didn't see the show, but The Woman in White, that Andrew Lloyd Webber thing that was apparently all on screens.
Yeah.
Like when it hit, like nobody wanted that, right? But like fast forward to 2020, suddenly like there are a lot, like Dear Evan Hansen really like uses screens really, really well. And other shows, like that's just the first one that pops in mind. But like, I feel like our tolerance level for certain things changes as we mature and as aesthetics change and whatnot. So like, I feel like it's very probable. Like, imagine if they tried to remount this today, maybe they wouldn't go with a puppet.
Yeah,
you know, like maybe it would be something else or whatever. Who knows?
But I think also, like any, you know, person or creative person, when you have more experience with the toy, you have more confidence with it and are able to try new things with it. So right. Like with Woman in White and the projections, I think the whole thing was the gimmick that like, it's all projections. Right. And everyone's like, but it also looks like a screensaver, and it's not done very inventively. And now the technology has improved, but also I think designers are becoming more creative with things like projection, learning how to incorporate into sets and find new ways to, you know, make it interesting.
The best use of screens I've seen in recent years is the Cher show. And, you know, I will buy myself just saying.
Oh, the Cher show. She was so Cher. I went to go see that and I was disappointed it wasn't about Cher Horowitz and Clueless. I was misled.
Such a missed opportunity.
You know what song I actually really enjoy? And I wish it got more love, because when you listen to it, I think because David Lindsay Abaire's lyrics are so good. I will also say, I think this is his first musical. Yeah. For a first musical, like, I think he's written some pretty damn good lyrics.
Well, I guess you can do that when you're a genius.
I guess so. Oops, sorry about it. But Travel Song has some really great lyrics in it. My personal favorite is "This ass of mine is asinine." I think that's so fucking clever. I threw my shoe across the room.
Do you remember that? I mean, we're all sort of playing Wordle now, but do you remember that game, Words with Friends?
Mm-hmm.
So, many years back, I challenged David Lindsay Abaire to a game of Words with Friends, and he slaughtered me. And I thought to myself, I'm just not in the zone. I'll try this again. Challenged him again, slaughters me again. Third time, I'm like, okay, you can do this. You're a lyricist, Tim. You can do this. No. Three times, he wiped my ass. He tripled my score. I mean, I was never even in the game.
And then you remembered, this is a man who wrote a play about anagrams.
yes. Then I remembered. I mean, God, this guy is just, I love him. I do. I'm friends with him. He's too fucking smart. Fuck you, David Lindsay Abaire.
That you're friends with him too. That makes me think highly of you. I'm not friends with David Lindsay Abaire.
That he's friends with me is what should make you think highly of him. I'm definitely a charity case when it comes to David Lindsay Abaire.
I mean, I've been enjoying you thoroughly. I can see why he's friends with you. I'm just saying, I don't know him none. It clearly means something good.
Not for nothing, but I invited him to crash this Zoom, and he was like, no, man, I'd be too scared to do it.
That's because he listened to my Cats episode and he went, oh God, Matt's going to say the meanest things to me. And I'd be like, no, I really loved Kimberly Akimbo at the Atlantic. I can't wait till it comes to Broadway.
I cannot wait till it comes to Broadway.
Yeah. It's going to be so good. It's so good. I know we're talking about Shrek, but Bonnie Milligan's first song in Kimberly Akimbo, where she's singing about, you know, you basically have to con your way through life. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact words, and I really hate quoting things when I don't know the exact words of it, but she's singing to Kimberly about all the different people she's come across in her life that she's basically duped. And one was a dude and one was an older woman. And when she talked about the dude, she has the list. She's like, he was cute. He was sweet. He was probably gay. And then the older woman, she goes, she was old. She was rich. She was legally blind. And I sat behind Jane Kaczmarek and both of us guffawed at the legally blind moment. It was so fun to watch an audience just lose their mind over really clever, genuinely funny lyrics.
Oh man. I mean, she's just in terms of, he has the total mastery over words. Who else would be like, let me save you all some time, gay, straight, gay. That is the funniest thing.
So funny. And that's not in the play, because the play doesn't have the teen chorus. So that was straight for the musical. Another thing I love is they're like, let's expand this and truly make this a musical. Okay. We got to start wrapping things up because we both have hard outs and we haven't even really discussed everything I wanted to talk about. But again, this is a companion piece. No, I think we talked about certain things very in depth, as opposed to discussing the whole show kind of shallowly. We discussed three or four points very in depth. And I think that is what makes this episode special, Timothy.
Thank you.
So I did mention, the show opened in 2008 for the 2009 Tony Awards, a variety of reviews, some mixed, some positive, some negative, running a little over a year. It was nominated for 8 Tony Awards, including Best Musical, Best Score. Do you know what it was up against for musical that year of 2009, Mr. Tony Voter?
Well, I wasn't a voter in 2009. I was.
Know your history. Know where you came from.
2009.
One is a British import.
Okay.
There's a lot of dance in it. And children.
Wait.
I want to dance the ballet, Dad.
Oh, it's okay. Billy Elliot.
Yeah, cut. Anyone who's listened to the Billy Elliot episode will know my friend Chelsea Williams and I have a bit where we quote Billy Elliot, but it's not actually in Billy Elliot. It's our own made-up quote from the show. I want to dance the ballet, Dad. You can't dance the ballet, Billy. It's not anywhere in the show, but it's
that was one of the shows that I loved the movie so much I couldn't bring myself to see the show, and I regret it because Tom Holland was a Billy Elliot.
Yes, he was. I might have actually seen him as Billy Elliot. I don't know. I saw it at the time he was in the show. Billy Elliot's a good show, great movie, very good show. The other show it's up against, Next Normal, and Rock of Ages. Rock of Ages famously not eligible for score, so it's up against Miss Dolly Parton and 9-2-5. It loses all but one Tony. They win for costume design, which I don't necessarily agree with. I think they won for most costume design.
Yes.
But alas, not up to me. So some random questions for you, Mr. Timothy. The Tesori tune. What is your favorite song in this show?
I mean, I gotta say Freak Flag is probably the easiest answer.
Where Gingerbread Man exclaims that he's an Aries.
Yeah. I mean, are we talking about like the song in and of itself? Like, are we including lyrical content? Are we talking about just music? Are we talking about like, you know, whether how well it serves the moment? Like, these are all different ways.
Yeah. So, okay. We can break this down into some categories because it's true, especially with Janine. It's never just one. What is the song you maybe bop out to the most? The song that you perhaps have the most lyrical or musical appreciation for? And then what do you think really kind of enacts musical theater the best? So, for example, I probably bop out to Morning Person the most, just because it's like so Partridge Family 70s. I think Who I'd Be is the most dramatically compelling musical theater one, with I Know It's Today a close second. Lyrically, Travel Song I think is just absolutely bonkers brilliant. But musically, I mean, I'd probably say I Know It's Today. I think I Know It's Today is musically really well done. And then of course the rhythm of I Got You Beat. You just can't beat that flatulence.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in agreement with all of those. I mean,
I do have perfect taste, so if you just don't agree with all of it, it's fine. But you did mention Freak Flag, so which is a bop. She's a bop, but I just, for some reason, the fairy tale characters I don't come back to as often.
I don't either. I mean, I guess, this is interesting. Something that I did want to talk about when you asked me about you asked me about song moments that didn't work. I'm not a genius. I like what I like. I'm not Janine Tesori. So it's very weird. It feels a little disingenuous for me to be critical about, you know, anything. That said, there are I really appreciate that in this score she will think horizontally as often as she thinks vertically, if that makes sense.
Explain to me.
She'll put an emphasis on melody horizontally as often as she'll put an emphasis on verticality, harmony, right? Like front and centered. But like the thing, like and you know, I think it, I mean, I'm not her, so I don't know her, so I haven't asked her this, but I think if I'm thinking, it seems to me that when she does it vertically, what she's really doing is trying to get out of everyone's way. There's a lot of noise, let's just like get out of the way and let the let the performance be the center, let the character be the center, let the lyric be the, whatever that is. And I find that in those, and that's like the most generous thing that a composer can do, is not will themselves onto something. But I find in this particular piece, the moments that didn't really work for me were those moments where she's thinking horizontally or vertically instead of horizontally. And they all happen to fall on these big ensemble fairy tale creature numbers, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
At least from my memory of having screened it once over two nights, because I have a 2-year-old child.
Yeah. It's, I mean, because there's also an irony to the fairy tale character songs. Like Story of My Life is a very, you know, kind of rolling of the eyes kind of song, intentionally so. And she, I don't know if it's that they don't reach the potential or if I just don't gravitate towards that kind of stuff, because listening to it, I was like, I mean, they do the assignment, they do the song that is asked of them there. I don't know, I can't think of them doing it better. I don't find ironic musical theater songs to be all that worthy of re-listening. So I think that's just my own personal taste. Next question. Gimme a revival, please. Who would you like to see in this show? And we already kind of talked about this bit, but how would you like to see it done?
Oh, that's, I mean, God, that's, I, oh, you're going to be so dissatisfied because I haven't thought about these and I'm a slow, like I need to think about these things. I think that, honest to God, a revival with Bonnie Milligan would fucking rock my world. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Go-Go's musical.
I did, Head Over Heels, yeah.
Head Over Heels. I loved that show so much. And I can't believe, like, I cannot believe she didn't get nominated. I was so, I wanted to vote for her so bad.
You were ready, too.
I was so ready. I think... God, who would be a good Shrek? See, that's tough because I'm not sure I love that character. Like, does that make sense? Like,
Well, I think if we've, so like, let's think of it for a second. Black box, no set, no costumes, just like actors, right?
Right.
That then I'm starting to think of, you know, who would play well off of Bonnie? Who do I see singing Who I'd Be? And like getting the gruffness, but then also the fragility, the toxic masculinity, if you will.
I know that like I'm a person of color and I write for people of color, but the first person that pops into my head is Josh Gad.
Yeah. He'd be pretty good. I mean, I love to hear Joshua Henry sing Who I'd Be? 100%. Do I think he could do the more comedic elements? I don't know. We have not been allowed to see that part of him yet.
Okay, full confession, I got to Josh Gad via Josh Henry. So
of course you did.
I didn't want to, I was like, yeah.
Josh and Josh. Yeah. Well, so I was actually trying to think. So for some reason, Raymond Lee has been on my brain a lot because I'm a big Groundhog Day fan. And I thought he was so funny in the show. I saw Groundhog Day 3 times. And I remember his scene, the nobody cares scene. I loved his deadpan comic delivery. I think his voice is insane. I was like, he'd make a good donkey. I would love to see what he would do with Donkey.
You know, I know Ray. I've worked with Ray. He would slay Donkey.
I think so.
I'm at a place now where all I want to do is cast Ray in strong romantic leads.
Then make him Shrek.
Yeah.
Shrek.
I think that that's right. Yes.
Yeah, I don't mind. He's talented enough. I think the reason I put him down for Donkey is because while I love Daniel Breaker, I mean, when Shrek was coming to Broadway and he replaced Chester Gregory James out of town, I was so obsessed with Passing Strangers, like, let's see what he does. And then I was a little disappointed he was kind of doing an Eddie Murphy impression. Which, again, fair, in all fairness, like, Eddie Murphy was so well known in the role, you're kind of stuck in that mold. Someone like Ray, I feel like, would be able to break out of that box a bit, would be able to think of new things. But not just him, like, there are so many other really strong comedic actors out there. But yeah, let's put Ray and Shrek, Ray and Bonnie together. I'll see that in our streamlined, stripped down, has some fantastical elements to the design, but isn't overblown. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. We're gonna put it in the Lyceum Theater. See how that goes. Next question. Raise Me Up. Do you think the show was properly appreciated when it came out? Properly appreciated. Whether meaning you think the response was accurate to what was there.
I mean, I think that if I have any criticism over theater as an industry in general, and and the creative minds that are being, the creative voices that are being heard in the Broadway space, I would say that, like, my criticism would be that they almost never see the forest for the trees. It's always about cult of personality. It's always about, like, you know, this is how I'm feeling about the world today. So this is something that I'm going to identify with. This piece of theater is what I'm going to identify with, regardless of whether of its actual quality, you know, and its quality might be great. I'm just saying that's always going to be an afterthought, because I feel like we're always looking at, like, we just can't focus on the things that matter, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
I say that as somebody who knows too many, like, writers who've been overlooked, who continue to be overlooked. You know, I say that as a writer who's been overlooked. Project much? No. So did it get, what was the question again?
Do we think it was properly appreciated when it first came out?
No, I don't. I don't think anything is properly appreciated when it first comes around, for better or worse.
Well, I mean, not for nothing, but this whole series, Janine's whole history on Broadway, you could argue, you know, she was not properly appreciated when her shows came out. Fun Home is really the first show she has that opens on Broadway where, like, the critics immediately go, yes, no, this is good. A lot of them, it takes them a while. And it's a shame because, I mean, again, with Shrek, Brantley's review was sort of mixed, leaning towards negative. He sort of begrudgingly admits it's better than he thought it would be, but I think he can't bring himself to give a positive review to a show like this. And what makes it a shame is, like, yes, we discussed the things that don't work for us, things that we thought maybe were hindering the material as well, but there is a lot of good here still. This is a genuinely good score. You know, with the original cast has some very strong performances in it, and that should be acknowledged. And it's a shame that it really wasn't at the time. And I'm hoping now, especially as we mentioned before, like, all the schools and regional theaters and community theaters that are doing it, people are recognizing that there's merit to it. Happening.
I think this goes in line with my thoughts about, like, taking something on its own terms too. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this show is outrageously consistent in terms of what it's trying to be and versus what it's telling us it is, you know. Mm-hmm. And for that, like, any piece that knows exactly what it is, that doesn't lie about it, kind of deserves, I think, our attention and the benefit of the doubt, you know. So anyways,
fully agreed. Fully agreed. And then the final question, Caroline it or change it? Is there anything in this show that you'd want to alter?
Brilliant.
I'm an idiot.
This production or this show?
The show. Like, if there was a song that you would, like, let's say you were the director and you sat down with Janine and Dave and you're like, guys, great here. It's like, I think we could maybe try better on this one. Is there anything here that you would Caroline or change?
Honestly, Story of My Life is one that I would re-examine. And I also, this might be sacrilege to some, I think Big Bright Beautiful World deliberately pulls a punch. Like, it wants us to think that it's like this great, like, kind of him sort of, you know, identifying, it's just the feel good, like, it's just trying to be these, I feel like it's deliberately trying to deceive us. And I don't think that's its friend. I think that, like, you know how, like, there's a sort of, what am I trying to say? Like they don't want that song to be better than Who I'd Be, right? Because that's sort of where the I Want number would be, is Big Bright Beautiful World. Mm-hmm. And so, like, they kind of pull their punches a little bit. And I feel like, no. Make that the best fucking number you can. And then just make Who I'd Be even better, you know, or whatever that, like, obviously this is posthumous, like, it's already been written, but, like, But don't be afraid of being like awesome always, you know?
Yeah, I get that. It's hard to figure out what to do with Big Red Beautiful World because I think it starts really well. I like the sort of dark humor of, you know, the parents kicking him out. And musically, it does build at the end, but there's something about it. But I agree with you. Like, there's something about it that something is just missing. It's not that it's bad. It's perfectly solid, but like there is some kind of punch missing to it. So whether that's like about coming back to it and tweaking it in a way, or writing a whole new song.
I think what I was trying to articulate now that you've said this is it's there's something that's not wholly satisfying about it, right?
Like, yes.
And I think it's deliberately not giving us that. And I think that that's not the show's friend. I say, just give it to us and then like, see what happens then. Like make it, you know.
I mean, I'd argue it's Hamilton, you know, the opening song is not fantastic. It's like a perfectly fine opening song. And it's because it sort of sets up my shot to be like the grand slam, which, you know, works for the show. It's clearly doing well without any of my input, but I'm like, wouldn't it be amazing if both Alexander Hamilton and my shot were both slam dunks instead of like one was the volley and the other one was the spike? But you know, again,
that's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah,
exactly. Clearly Hamilton is working for them. Shrek maybe a little less so. All right, those are my questions. Timothy, thank you very much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. I hope this wasn't like a total waste of everyone's time.
I had a blast. I don't care what anyone else thinks. Okay. Timothy, where can people find you if you want them to find you?
You can literally just Google my name and I'm on the first page because guys with my name are either like doing medical stuff or me. So yeah, you don't even have to do comma musical. Like you can literally just type in my name.
Yeah. And if you want to learn more about him, literally the first page of his website tells you so much about him. He's very upfront. He's concise. It's great. It's my favorite kind of writer. He's like, why write paragraphs when I can write six lines explaining who I am?
I'm tired of, yeah. Well, you know, that'll be the episode where you interview writers. I don't need to talk anymore about that. But yeah, no, I'm on Instagram. I'm Timothy Huangstagram. I have a Twitter account, but I never really use it except to tell celebrities I think they're awesome. And I have a YouTube and like a SoundCloud. And I mean, it's just type in my name. You'll be fine.
Type in his name. He's all over the place. And not for nothing, but he knows David Lindsay a bear. So,
indeed,
you know,
I'll do.
He's kind of a big deal. If you want to find me, guys, I'm on Instagram and Instagram only at Matt Koplik. I did get a TikTok. By this point, I will have deleted it because I hate it so much. Don't have a Twitter. Thank the Lord. Facebook is for just my mom. And yeah, if you like the podcast, rate, review, subscribe, give us 5-star rating, give us a nice little review. If you don't like the podcast, you can tell me so in a review, but make sure it's a 5-star rating anyway, because the algorithm is real. Join us next week as we cover the fourth Broadway musical of Janine Desori, not the fourth show she's written. It's actually her first musical, but it's finally making its Broadway debut, once again starring Miss Sutton Foster. It is called Violet, not the color purple, but Violet. Timothy, we close out every episode with a nice diva, usually of Broadway or musical theater standing. We have, of course, closed out with Sutton Foster already. We actually have closed out with Jennifer Simard, who is in the ensemble of Shrek. I'm going to do a stretch here. But there is an actress who did Shrek the musical her senior year of high school before she went off to star in Steven Spielberg's West Side Story as Maria. I'm, of course, talking about Rachel Zegler. So I think we will close out with Rachel Zegler, who I have been obsessed with since seeing West Side Story on November 29th. I'm just waiting for you to be like, really? Or amazing. So I'm glad that you affirm it. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And we'll catch you next week. Take us away, Rachel. Bye.
I feel pretty, oh so pretty, that the city should give me its key. A committee should be organized to honor me.
La, 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 la.
I feel dizzy. I feel sunny. I feel busy and funny and fun. I'm so pretty. Miss America can just reason.
La 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 la.
See that pretty girl in that mirror there? What's me or where?
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.